Before we begin this episode, we would like to send out a special thanks to our new sponsor, Postmates, for supporting the Trail When Cold. As usual, your stomach and the rest of your life are at war. You need to eat, but you can't stop what you're doing to deal with it, and the only fast things that deliver are not what you want. For a limited time, Postmates is giving you $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. To start your free deliveries, download the Postmates app and use the promo code COLD. Once again, download the Postmates app, and the promo code is COLD. Thank you, and enjoy the show. September 14th, 1965. Coral Gables, Florida. After leaving work, 22-year-old Judith Hyams vanishes without a trace, and a rental car is found abandoned in Atlanta. It turns out that Judith was pregnant and had been seeking an illegal abortion, but when the alleged doctor is arrested, he jumps bail and disappears. 24 years later, a police captain receives bizarre anonymous phone calls stating that Judith is still alive, prompting him to reopen the case. Investigators soon receive an anonymous letter revealing that Judith died of complications from her abortion, but her body is never found, and the source of the strange phone calls remains unknown. After that, the trail went cold.
Capture.
Judy Hyams is alive, and she lives in Omaha.
Who is this, please?
Judy Hyams is alive, and she lives in Omaha.
Who is this? Hello, who is this?
Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to 2019's first episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and I thought it would be great to ring in the new year by exploring a classic unsolved mysteries case, the 1965 disappearance of Judith Hyams. That sound clip you just heard is from an Unsolved Mysteries reenactment in which a police captain received an anonymous phone call about the victim 24 years after she went missing. To this day, if you ever recite the words, "Judy Hyams is alive and she lives in Omaha," to an Unsolved Mysteries fan, they'll immediately know what you're talking about. This is a pretty unique mystery in that the solution seemed pretty straightforward at the time it originally took place, as the most likely explanation was that Judy had died from complications during an illegal abortion, and the responsible parties covered the whole thing up. However, nearly a quarter century after the case faded into obscurity, it was revived in the most unlikely fashion when the Coral Gables Police Department started receiving incredibly bizarre anonymous phone calls from multiple individuals, one of whom stated that Judy was still alive in another state. Quite frankly, the biggest mystery in this case is not what happened to Judy, but why her story was revived by these phone calls completely out of the blue so many years later. Whatever you believe happened, the most important thing is that Judy has still never been found, so this is an unsolved mystery which deserves exploration. But before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Judith Hyams. Our story begins in 1965 in the city of Coral Gables, Florida, located near downtown Miami. Our central figure is 22-year-old Judith Hyams, who goes by the name Judy. Judy is the daughter of a wealthy developer and works as a lab technician in the University of Miami Medical School at Jackson Memorial Hospital. She is also a recent divorcee who split from her investment banker husband in June of this year, but has recently begun dating a local dentist named Lucien Gordon. On September 14th, Judy left work early and told one of her friends that she was planning to go shopping to purchase an expensive watch. The previous day, Judy had gone to Biscayne Federal Bank and withdrew $300, which she was presumably going to use to purchase the watch. While a watch was delivered to Judy's home the following day, she was not there at the time, and when she failed to surface, Judy was subsequently reported missing. 1 week later, police learned that an abandoned Chevrolet Impala registered under Judy's name had been found over 650 miles away in a residential neighborhood in Atlanta. Since Judy's own vehicle had recently been damaged by Hurricane Betsy, the Impala was a rental car. There was a bloodstain found on the back seat, and over 50 latent fingerprints inside the vehicle, but the problem was that since this was a rental car, which had previously been used by multiple people, it was impossible to determine if any of the prints belonged to someone who might have had involvement in Judy's disappearance. Theoretically, even the bloodstain could have been left behind by someone who rented the car before Judy did, as the stain was small enough that it may have been caused by something as minor as cutting one's finger. A local resident had recalled seeing an unidentified man in his 20s with a sandy-haired crew cut and bad complexion parking the Impala in the neighborhood before he removed a duffel bag from the trunk and walked away. The witness then claimed she saw this man return to the scene a few days later with a dark-haired girl resembling Judy, and they both looked at the car before driving away in a Buick. Well, this man and woman were eventually tracked down, but it turned out the woman was not Judy, and it was not the same man who had abandoned the car. The couple had just heard a radio broadcast about the missing Impala, and when they saw it parked on the street, they decided to go check the tag numbers. While attempting to trace the man who parked the vehicle, investigators checked flight records and discovered that an individual only using the name Smith had paid cash to purchase a plane ticket from Atlanta to Miami shortly after the Impala was dropped off. However, they were unable to track him down, and the driver was never identified. Investigators soon uncovered a potential explanation for why Judy went missing, as a receipt for a pregnancy test was found among her personal effects. The test had taken place at a medical lab on August 31st, and she had used the name B. Keeney. However, one of the lab technicians was able to confirm that B. Keeney was Judy because they had gone to technician school together and she recognized her. 4 days after Judy disappeared, an attorney named Daniel Sepler approached the state's attorney's office, claiming that two other attorneys had asked him for advice on behalf of a potential client who might have been involved in procuring or aiding a criminal abortion. Sepler said this was connected to the quote-unquote missing girl, and found out the attorneys had received phone calls from the office of a doctor named Gordon, and the actual abortionist was someone with a name that was difficult to pronounce. Well, Judy just happened to know two doctors with the last name Gordon. Dr. Lucien Gordon, the dentist whom she had recently started dating, and Dr. Herschel Gordon, who was a friend of the Himes family. The two men weren't related, though Herschel was the one who had introduced Judy to Lucien. When Judy took her pregnancy test, the lab asked her for the name of the doctor she could mail the results to, and she provided the address for Lucien's office. Both of the Gordons were subpoenaed to appear at the state attorney's office, but Herschel refused to answer any questions without the presence of an attorney. He also wouldn't speak to Judy's family, and eventually moved to California. However, the family believed that Judy would have trusted Herschel enough to go to him if she needed a referral about an abortion. While Lucien was initially cooperative with investigators, he kept postponing his appointments to speak with the state attorney's office, and finally started pleading the Fifth Amendment when he was asked questions under oath. Anyway, as you probably know, abortion was still illegal in 1965, and it was suspected that the aforementioned abortionist with the difficult-to-pronounce name was a Hungarian immigrant named George Hagyu. When Hagyu was questioned, he admitted that he had met Judy on a previous occasion years earlier, but denied having seen her on the day she went missing. Well, needless to say, Hagyu had quite a shady history. The previous year, Hagyu had been charged with conspiracy to commit abortion following a sting operation in which an undercover female police officer arranged to have an illegal abortion performed by him for $500. Haju would also be charged with unlawful practice of medicine once it was discovered that he did not actually have a medical license. Haju claimed that he was licensed to practice medicine in his native Hungary, though he admitted he did not have a valid license in the United States. The rumors surrounding Judy's disappearance actually played a role in prompting Dade County law enforcement officials to put together what they described as a quote-unquote special abortion squad, which would bring down a number of illegal abortion rings over the next few years. In fact, in May of 1966, Haju, a 20-year-old nurse named Donna Duhan, and a third defendant, 42-year-old J. Anderson Martin, would be arrested for their roles in a completely unrelated abortion case. Anyway, after 2 years, Lucien Gorn finally agreed to come clean and share everything he knew about Judy's disappearance. Lucien finally admitted that he went with Judy to Haju's apartment 4 days before she disappeared, and they made an arrangement for him to perform an abortion on her at his clinic for $300. Lucien was not present when Judy went to the appointment at the clinic, as Haju assured her that she would not require assistance to drive home following the procedure. In September of 1967, Haju was officially charged by the state attorney's office for conspiring to perform an abortion on Judith Hyams. Haju was released on bond, but subsequently disappeared, and it was suspected that he fled the country. Without Haju, there really wasn't much else that could be done to find Judy, so the investigation hit a complete standstill. There was some speculation that Judy might have disappeared voluntarily because of the social stigma surrounding her alleged abortion, but her friends and family did not find this plausible, since she had received a $25,000 settlement from her divorce, and the money remained untouched in her bank account. After being missing 7 years, Judy was declared legally dead, and the $25,000 was turned over to her family. The case pretty much faded into obscurity, but would return to the spotlight again after a very unlikely series of events. In March of 1990, Captain Chuck Shearer of the Coral Gables Police Department received a phone call from a man identifying himself as Steve Brown, a radio talk show host in Omaha, Nebraska. Brown told Shearer that he had recently received information about the unsolved disappearance of Judith Hyams from an anonymous caller who phoned his show and told him Judy was currently living in Omaha. Of course, even though Shearer worked for the Coral Gables PD, Judy's disappearance took place many years before he joined the force, so he had never heard of the case before. He told Brown that he would do some research and get back to him, so Brown provided Shearer with two phone numbers where he could reach him. Anyway, after looking into the case, Shearer called Brown back, but this is where things got really strange, because Brown literally had no idea what was going on. Brown told Shearer that he never phoned him, never received any information from an anonymous caller, and knew nothing about the Judith Hyams case. Furthermore, while the number where Shearer phoned Brown was his radio station, the second number the caller had provided was Brown's home number, which was unlisted. Brown claimed that only about 50 people even knew that number, and he did not picture any of them being brazen enough to impersonate him while phoning the police. Well, things got even weirder 2 days later, when Shearer received another call, this time from a female, who said, "Judy Hyams is alive, and she lives in Omaha." When Shearer asked the caller to identify herself, she just kept repeating the same sentence before she hung up. Now, what's significant here is that only 2 days before these phone calls took place, Shearer had returned from a trip to Grand Island, Nebraska, approximately 150 miles west of Omaha, where he delivered a narcotics lecture at a police academy. However, since he had not heard of the Judith Hyams case at that point, Shearer never mentioned it to anyone while he was in Nebraska. While he had given his business card to a few law enforcement people during his trip, Shearer could not figure out why people from Omaha were suddenly phoning him about an obscure 24-year-old cold case. When Judy's family was informed about this, they confirmed that they did not know anyone in Nebraska. Regardless, these calls compelled Shearer to reopen the case, and a story about it ran in a local newspaper. It wasn't long before Shearer received another anonymous phone call, this time from a man who claimed to be an informant for the FBI and would not provide his name. He claimed that George Haju had returned to his native Hungary and was now living in Budapest. The caller said he had recently spent several weeks with Haju and even provided a phone number for him. Well, unlike the previous two calls, some of the information here actually checked out. Shearer contacted Interpol, and they confirmed that the phone number the caller provided did match up to someone named George Haju, though they were unable to locate him. Whatever the motives for these phone calls were, they helped rejuvenate Judy's case, and led to her story being featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired on January 2nd, 1991. 4 days after the episode aired, the Coral Gables PD received an anonymous typewritten letter which read, quote, "Judith Hyams is not alive. She came in for an abortion and was given an injection of anesthetic to which she had an immediate allergic reaction. Everything that could be done was done, however the reaction was fatal. The body was disposed of in Biscayne Bay." End quote. For those that aren't aware, Biscayne Bay is a 428 square mile body of water located on the Atlantic coast of Miami. Unsolved Mysteries subsequently ran an update in which law enforcement urged the writer of the letter to come forward and assured them that because the statute of limitations had expired, there would be no criminal prosecution for any role they might have had in Judy's disappearance, and they would guarantee total confidentiality. The writer never did come forward, but the police found the letter to be credible and pretty much closed their investigation. However, the case technically remains unsolved, as both the letter writer and the people behind the anonymous phone calls have never been identified, George Haju was never found, and after 5 decades, Judith Hyams is still a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send another special thanks to Postmates, as we are thrilled that they are now supporting our podcast. Like I mentioned at the outset, your stomach and the rest of your life are often at war with each other. Human beings need to eat, but you often can't stop what you're doing to deal with the problem, and you'll often run into a situation where the only fast things available for delivery are not what you want. I mean, I host this podcast and produce weekly episodes, so of course I'm always busy, and when I need to eat, I just want to order my food as quickly and efficiently as possible and not have limited options. I really don't want to record a podcast episode about that time I ordered food, it arrived late, or not at all, and have to close off the story either by saying, the trail, or food, went cold. So that's why I'm happy to introduce Postmates, the app which adds a delivery option to your favorite restaurants. Just imagine, anything you want to eat being delivered to you. You don't have to drive, park, or even talk on the phone to order. All you have to do is download the app and order. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, Postmates will bring you what you want within the hour. You can even see where your food is and track the driver. You forgot to get eggs and milk? No problem. Craving a tasty burger? Check. Looking for the perfect bottle of red wine or a summer beer? Order up. Postmates is your new long-term munchies booty call. I'm excited to announce that for a limited time, Postmates is giving you $100 of free delivery credits for your first 7 days. To start your free deliveries, download the Postmates app today and use the promo code COLD. Once again, the promo code is COLD, and it will get you $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. So save the hassle. Get the food you love fast. Download the Postmates app and enter the promo code COLD. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. So the Unsolved Mysteries segment about this story is pretty much a case study in how that show was capable of making anything spooky. People often rank the Judy Hyams is alive and she lives in Omaha phone call as one of the creepier moments on the show, thanks to the ominous music they play over it and the shots of the anonymous female caller speaking inside a dark room. That's pretty remarkable, given that the whole situation may have been nothing more than a simple prank call. Now, this is one of those mysteries to which one could easily apply the phrase, it's not the destination, it's the journey. Even though it's technically unsolved, I do believe the solution to this mystery is a straightforward one. I think the anonymous letter the Coral Gables Police Department received is probably legitimate, and that Judy likely died because of complications arising from an illegal abortion, and her body wound up in Biscayne Bay. Once the evidence surfaced following Judy's disappearance that she was pregnant and planning an abortion, everyone figured this may have caused her death, but the investigation just came to a dead halt once George Haju jumped bail and disappeared in 1967. If the story had just ended at that point, this wouldn't be much of a mystery, but then the phone calls happened. I know that most unsolved missing persons cases get their fair share of prank calls and false tips, but the fact that these took place 24 years later, after everyone had completely forgotten about this case, is a true head-scratcher. I mean, let's just assume the calls were some sort of practical joke. If you wanted to do something like that today, you could easily just go to the Charlie Project website, bring up the profile page for some obscure cold case, which contains the contact info for the investigating agency, and then phone them up to troll them. But this was the pre-internet world of 1990, so it would take a lot of work for someone from Omaha, Nebraska, to dig up information about a 24-year-old missing persons case from Coral Gables, Florida, of which there hadn't been any developments in 2 decades. If you go to newspapers.com, you can find a number of old articles about Judy's disappearance from the 1960s, which were covered in Florida-based publications, but I don't see any indication that this story made national news. Another strange detail is that there were separate phone calls from a man and a woman, so if this was an elaborate hoax, at least 2 people had to be involved. This is reminiscent of the episode I did a few months ago about the disappearances of Beth Miller, Tiffany Sessions, and Tracy Crow. Years after they went missing, an anonymous tipster called the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children hotline to say that all 3 of these victims were being held captive in a prostitution ring in Texas, even though they had each disappeared from different states at different times, and these cases had no apparent connection to one another. The call was ultimately written off as a hoax, but it just seemed so bizarre and random, since it would have been a hassle to obtain information about these 3 cases in 1994. But before we delve too deeply into this topic, let's start at the very beginning. Since the Unsolved Mysteries segment put most of their focus on the phone calls in this case, they kind of glossed over many of the details about Judith Himes' pregnancy. While they mentioned she was a recent divorcee, they did not provide any information about who the father of her unborn child might have been. Well, after doing more research into the original media coverage of Judy's disappearance, it sounds like this was quite a scandalous story at the time. It now seems apparent that after divorcing her husband, Judy became involved with Dr. Lucien Gordon and that an unplanned pregnancy occurred. As you're probably aware, this was still several years before Roe v. Wade, so abortions were illegal, and if a woman wanted one, she would have to do so under the radar. And unfortunately, this meant having to visit shady individuals like George Hodgew, who did not even have a legitimate license to practice medicine in the United States, and had already faced legal trouble for performing abortions before Judy even met him. It's quite surreal to go back and read old newspaper articles about law enforcement putting together quote-unquote special abortion squads during this time period to crack down on the problem, and using undercover female officers to set up elaborate sting operations. I know one of the big turning points in the abortion reform movement during the 1960s took place 1 year before Judy's disappearance, when a Connecticut woman named Jerry Santoro became pregnant after an affair with a married man named Clyde Dixon. 6 months into her pregnancy, they both checked into a motel to perform a self-induced abortion, but Santoro died of complications, and Dixon fled the scene rather than seek medical attention, so he was charged with manslaughter. This incident showed the lengths women had to go to at that time without access to legal abortion. Now, I have no idea if Judy had any desire to have children, or if she and Lucien Gordon were interested in pursuing a serious long-term relationship, but I do know that Judy had just gone through a divorce at age 22, and she had become pregnant with a man whom she'd only recently started dating and was not married to. Even if Judy genuinely wanted to have Lucien's child, this still would have been an incredibly scandalous situation for 1965, and there would be a major social stigma attached to the whole thing. One of Judy's friends was interviewed during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, and flat out said that having children while unmarried just wasn't done back then. It became apparent that Judy had decided to confide about her pregnancy with a family friend, Dr. Herschel Gordon, who subsequently referred her to George Hodgew. While Lucien was not pregnant when Judy went to have her abortion, he was with her when she made the original arrangements with Hodgew. They may not have known any better at the time, but hearing that Hodgew told Judy it was okay for her to drive herself home after the procedure is a major red flag. It doesn't sound Lucien had any direct involvement in Judy's disappearance, since she went to the appointment alone, but he chose to remain silent for 2 years before agreeing to testify as a witness against Haju when he was charged with conspiring to perform an abortion. But of course, since Haju jumped bail, no trial ever took place. Sadly, I have no trouble believing that something went horribly wrong during the procedure, which cost Judy her life, and then Haju disposed of her body to cover the whole thing up. One of the most curious aspects of this story is that Judy's rental car was found over 650 miles away in Atlanta. I can understand the logic behind that, as I'm guessing Haju had someone drive it there because he wanted to distance Judy as far away from him as possible. Perhaps this was done to give off the impression that Judy took off voluntarily, or that she was abducted by someone and became the victim of foul play. He also might have figured that abandoning the car in another state would cause jurisdictional issues. By the time the car made it back to Coral Gables, it had been handled by so many different agencies that it was impossible to preserve the vehicle as a crime scene. But it's still pretty odd that the driver would leave the vehicle in a residential neighborhood rather than somewhere remote, as a witness flat out saw him walking away from the car. I know traces of blood were found in the back seat, so it's easy to assume the vehicle had been used to dispose of Judy's body, but this aspect of the story might be exaggerated. Looking back at the original newspaper articles, it sounds like the actual amount of blood they found was so small that it could have been caused by someone cutting their finger, and since it was a rental car, it's possible the bloodstain could have been there before Judy even drove it. One mystery in this case which has never been resolved is the identity of the man who drove the car to Atlanta. He was described as being a white male in his 20s with a blonde crew cut, so I'm pretty sure it wasn't George Haju. So who could this man have been? I know that when Haju was arrested in another unrelated abortion case 1 year later, he had a co-defendant named J. Anderson Martin, though it's unclear what his exact role was. However, since Martin was 42 years old, and the man in Atlanta was described as being in his 20s, I'm not sure it was him either. It sounds like police suspected he was an airline passenger who used the name Smith to purchase a ticket for a flight from Atlanta to Miami on the day the car was dropped off. The fact that you used to be able to pay cash to purchase an airline ticket without even giving your full name is quite a sign of just how much things have changed in 50 years. It doesn't look like they ever figured out who this guy was, though his role takes on more significance when you consider that the case was eventually revived by an anonymous male caller, but we'll talk about that momentarily. Anyway, once Judy's disappearance was linked to Haju, everyone suspected that he was responsible. Had he not skipped bail, and they were able to convict him of conspiring to perform an abortion, it's possible that Haju might have eventually confessed that Judy died while under his care. If her body was really dumped in Biscayne Bay, then it probably would have been impossible to recover it, but at least everyone would have known the full truth about what actually happened to her. Even after Haju disappeared, I think Judy's family and friends had come to terms with the fact that she was dead, and they were probably never going to find her. I'm sure they never dreamed of the possibility that her case would be revived over 2 decades later by an anonymous caller who claimed she was still alive somewhere, paving the way to her story being featured on national network television. Okay, so this new series of events all started when Coral Gables police captain Chuck Shearer received a phone call from someone claiming to be Steve Brown, who said he had received new information about Judith Himes' disappearance. Now, given that Brown was a radio show host in Omaha, and this call took place just 2 days after Shearer returned from a lecture at a police academy in Nebraska, you'd assume there was a connection. But the problem is that Shearer's lecture did not actually take place in Omaha, but at an academy in Grand Island, a city which is 150 miles away. I'm just trying to figure out a logical explanation for how these events might have played out. Let's just say that Shearer went to this lecture, and someone living in Nebraska had knowledge of the Judith Himes case, and just happened to find out a Coral Gables police captain had been there. Shearer did say he handed out a few business cards during his trip, so perhaps one of these cards wound up in the hands of someone with information they wanted to share. I can understand them feeling compelled to phone Shearer, but what I cannot understand is their decision to impersonate an Omaha radio host whom Shearer had never even met before. If the caller was worried about incriminating himself and wanted to remain anonymous, that would be one thing. But pretending to be someone who was a fairly recognizable personality in the Omaha area and providing Scheer with that person's work and home phone numbers is another. I find it interesting how Scheer told the caller he had to get back to him after researching the case, which is why he provided those two numbers for Scheer to call him back. But what would the caller have said if Scheer immediately pressed him for information? Would he have actually shared something pertinent about Judith Hyams? Again, I just don't see what the purpose would be for impersonating Steve Brown, especially since Brown didn't know anything about the case. Since the caller provided Scheer with Brown's unlisted home number, which only a limited amount of people would have known, he probably had some sort of personal connection to Brown. On the surface, the most logical explanation is that someone was playing an elaborate prank to cause confusion, but the biggest issue with that theory is, what would possess them to use the Judith Hyams case? How would someone in Omaha have even found out about it to begin with? It just seems like the most inexplicably random starting point for a practical joke. Of course, the confusion was compounded 2 days later when Captain Scheer received the anonymous call from the woman who said, "Judy Hyams is alive, and she lives in Omaha." Since the chances of two completely unrelated people deciding to phone up the police about an obscure 24-year-old cold case are pretty much non-existent, it's a given that both the male and female callers were in on this together, but who knows what their motives might have been. If these calls took place today, it would probably be easy to trace them, or at least determine where they originated from, but back in 1990, they didn't have the technology for that. This call prompted investigators to explore the possibility that Judy really was alive and living in Omaha after all those years, or that perhaps the caller was even Judy herself. But given all the evidence that Judy went to have an abortion and never returned, it seems very doubtful she was still alive. I know they briefly explored the possibility that even if Judy survived the abortion, she might have felt the stigma was so large that she decided to cut off all contact with her family and friends and start a new life somewhere. But it seemed very doubtful that Judy would remain in hiding that long, particularly once abortion became legalized. Not to mention that she left behind $25,000 in a bank account that was never touched. So in spite of what the caller might have said, I seriously doubt that Judy was alive and living in Omaha in 1990. But we still have to ask, why Omaha? On the off chance the caller was a tipster who legitimately believed she might have seen Judy Hyams in Omaha, why didn't she say anything else besides repeating the same sentence? And again, if this was nothing more than a prank, what compelled them to select that particular case? Was there any significance to the fact that a Coral Gables police captain had been in Nebraska days earlier? I know this is nothing more than a coincidence, but here's an interesting piece of trivia I thought was worth mentioning. At the time these calls took place, the police chief in Omaha was James Skinner, who resigned in 1997 and instantly became police chief in another city. And take a wild guess where? Coral Gables. I don't think that has any bearing on this case, but regardless, it's pretty crazy. Now the third call Captain Scheer received from the anonymous FBI informant, I think that one was legitimate and had no connection to the previous two calls. Remember, those calls prompted Scheer to reopen the investigation, and an article about Judy's disappearance ran in a local newspaper, which mentioned George Haju, so the informant could have easily read about the case, saw Haju's name, and felt compelled to phone in a tip. As you'll recall, the caller claimed that he'd recently spent several weeks with Haju in Hungary and provided a phone number. Even though they couldn't find Haju, Interpol confirmed that the phone number was linked to someone by that name, so I believe the caller was telling the truth. Investigators found it very unlikely that Haju himself was behind any of the phone calls, and I definitely agree with that, as I'm sure Haju had a very distinct Hungarian accent, which would have stuck out if he was one of the callers. To this day, Haju has never been found, and if he's still alive somewhere, he would be in his late 80s by now. Anyway, this series of events led to the case being featured on Unsolved Mysteries, followed by the anonymous letter to the Coral Gables PD, which detailed how Judy died because of complications from her abortion. The police found the letter to be credible, and I concur with that. Unlike the initial phone calls, this letter came in after the case had been broadcast on national television, so it would not surprise me if someone watched the episode and felt the need to clear their conscience. Of course, it seems doubtful that Haju was the writer, but if the outlined scenario from the letter was true, there were probably other people present when Judy died, such as a nurse, and we know that at least one male played a role in the cover-up by driving Judy's car to Atlanta. So the obvious question is, could the writer of the letter have been one of the people who made the phone calls? Well, there is one woman who might be a potential candidate to be the infamous Judy Himes is alive and she lives in Omaha caller. Like I mentioned earlier, in May of 1966, Haju, J. Anderson Martin, and a 20-year-old nurse named Donna Duhen were all arrested for their roles in another abortion case. I have no idea what actually happened to Donna Duhen, or if she served any jail time, but since this was only 8 months after Judy went missing, I think there's a good chance Duhen was Haju's nurse when Judy came in for her abortion. Even if Duhen wasn't the caller, she might be the best candidate to have written the anonymous letter, since it sounds like the writer had first-hand knowledge. But if Duhen was the caller, why would she be stating that Judy was still alive? She may have been trying to throw investigators off the track, but it's possible that seeing Judy's story on national TV was her breaking point, and finally compelled her to send in a letter with the complete truth. However, if Donna Duhen was the female caller, then who was the male caller who impersonated Steve Brown? Was the male caller directly involved in what happened to Judy? Or could Duhen have put someone else she knew up to this because she hadn't worked up the courage to phone anybody about the case on her own? Though I suppose the thing I just can't get a handle on is, if either or both of these callers did have knowledge about what transpired, what suddenly compelled them to come forward 24 years after the fact? Well, I have heard that sometime in the fall of 1989, a Miami newspaper ran an article about missing persons cases, and Judith Himes was mentioned. Unfortunately, I've been unable to find this article online, or 100% confirm it was published. But if Judy's case did get some publicity shortly before the call started, then the whole scenario does make a bit more sense. It's entirely possible that the whole thing was orchestrated not by someone who had direct involvement in Judy's disappearance, but by someone close to her who was motivated to get the investigation reopened after reading about it in the papers. And since there was an all-new team of investigators working for the Coral Gables PD at this point, they wanted to do something unique in order to plant the seeds about this case with them. Perhaps they somehow found out that Captain Shearer was traveling to Nebraska for a lecture and decided to come up with a very odd way to capture his attention by somehow tying Judy's case to Omaha. Because even though Shearer hadn't heard of the case before, the strange nature of the phone calls definitely got him intrigued enough to reopen the investigation, so if the caller's intention was to bring a forgotten cold case back into the spotlight, then they certainly accomplished their mission. But once again, I have to reiterate, what an ass-backwards way to do things. Even if someone did read about Judy's case in a Miami newspaper, what would compel them to impersonate a radio host from over 1,600 miles away? Unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever know the answers. Anyway, the mystery of the phone calls is such a jigsaw puzzle that I'm afraid the victim in this story sometimes gets overlooked. Sadly, I'm about 99% sure that Judith Himes died because of an abortion gone wrong, and if this story had taken place a decade later, I'm sure the circumstances would have been a lot different. If she did wind up in Biscayne Bay, they'll probably never be able to recover her body, and since the police officially closed the investigation following the anonymous letter, there really isn't much more they can do. Unless Judy was flat-out murdered, then the statute of limitations for whatever crimes took place have long expired. But whatever the motive was for the phone calls, at the very least, they did rescue Judith's case from obscurity and gave her story a bit more closure than it otherwise would have received. All that being said, if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Judith Himes, which could provide more concrete answers about what actually happened to her, please contact the appropriate authorities. Just don't impersonate a radio host when you're phoning the police. But if you have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards, as we've released some exclusive bonus episodes for our donors in Tiers 2 and 3. Our most recent bonus episode was titled The Trail Went Hot and explored some of the many cold cases which were solved in 2018. I think we can all agree that in regards to solving mysteries, 2018 was a truly amazing year in the annals of true crime. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give special shoutouts to our many listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon these past few weeks, and they are Andy W., Kathleen D., Jeannie K., Mike F., Becky P., Patrick, Catherine S., Cara F., Luis E., Antonio C., Orion G., and Emily K. Thank you all so much for your support. Also, just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear in every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So once again, a Happy New Year to everyone, and here's hoping that our podcast has a very successful 2019. Join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶